Hey, today is Tuesday, April 29th, or Rosh Chodesh Iyar. This is the Women's Mishnah Shir. We're in the first parak of Kedushin. Okay, Rabotai. We have been studying prior to Pesach the Mishnah which described obligations of a parent unto a child. And tonight, we're going to flip the coin and see the obligations of a child unto a parent. And here the Mishnah says that there is no difference between boys and girls in this regard, as opposed to the obligations of a parent unto a child. Many of them are limited to father's obligation, not the mother's obligation, but the obligation of children unto parents seem to be pretty consistent, that both boys and girls have this obligation, but there'll be one substantial difference which we will explore tonight as well. So the Braita says, I bracketed it for you. Tanina laha d'tana rabbanan. One of the obligations of a child unto a parent is the mitzvah of kibud and the mitzvah of yira. The mitzvah of kibud and the mitzvah of yira. And we are going to eventually see what the parameters are. You will not like what I have to say. You will not like it. Parents hate when I talk about this. Children love when I talk about this. But that's not for tonight. Because not tonight we're not going to see the parameters per se. But in discussing the pasuk of Yirah, we read it this past week, Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u. So the Braita now is going to establish the fact that a young man and a young lady are obligated to engage in a sense of reverence. Ish, says the Braita, ein li elo ish. If the Torah uses the expression ish imo ve'aviv tira'u, I could have said that the obligation is only upon a man. Because the Torah could easily have said imo ve'aviv tira'u, aim ve'av tira'u. Have fear for mother and father. Why introduce it with the word ish? So I could have said ein li elo ish, that the obligation to establish a sense of reverence is only for a man. Isha minayin. How do I know that a woman is obligated to establish a sense of reverence for her parents? Answers the Braita. Kishihu omer tira'u harei kan shnayin. The word tira'u is written in the plural. Had it been referring only to an ish, it should have said ish imo ve'aviv tira. Why tira'u? Speaking to two people. Obviously, if I'm speaking to two people, the word ish doesn't mean man, but a person. And I suspect that you are a person, as much as I am. I suspect that we have a braisa telling me that you're a person, just as much as a man is. Without the braisa, we may not have known that. Right. So, kishomer tira'u, harei kan shnayim. Im kein, if that's the case, ma talmud lomar ish. Why does the Torah use an expression which could have led to confusion? Why use that expression of ish imo ve'aviv tira'u? You say one thing, imo ve'aviv tira'u, aim ve'av ve'aim tira'u. And I would know it means two ra'us, two people. We assume means the children of the mother and the father. So why introduce it, preface it with the word ish? Answers the Gemara, ish sipek biyado la'asot. A man always has the opportunity to fulfill this mitzvah. Isha ein sipek biyada la'asot. A woman doesn't always have the opportunity or the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud av v'em to her parents. Mipnei sherishut acherim aleha. Because of the fact that someone else has some degree of control over her. Someone else, rishut acherim, someone else's control is upon her. Fine, stop right there. That's what the Gemara says. So now, just to take care of one quick point. If you know how to define kibud and yirah, you have to ask yourself a question about the discussion that we had thus far. Can anybody give me an operating definition of the mitzvah of kibud av v'em? Kibud. Okay, that's okay, but it's not accurate.
Taking care of the physical needs.
Providing service to parents. A service. Not necessarily providing a service unto your parent. That's what kibud means. We will learn the Gemara inside later on, not tonight, where the Gemara gives illustrations for kibud. And each one of those illustrations lead to that definition. Give them something to eat, help them get dressed, motzi'o umachniso, help them get in and out of the cab. All of that is kibud. So what is yirah? What then is yirah? What? What the Gemara gives illustrations for Yira.
What's the lower shape of
Kavod? Good.
Yeah.
Not to sit at the seat of the lo shelo yeshapim komam, lo la'amod bim komam. If they have a place where they stand in shul, or in the Gemara's case where they have a club, a bar, and your father or mother stood at a particular place at the bar, and shelo yistorit varav. You're not supposed to contradict them. So if our pasuk here is focusing on the pasuk in Kiddushim, which describes ish imo ve'aviv tira'u, how could you possibly have a situation where a woman would not be able to fulfill the mitzvah of yira? Because someone else's domain is a reshus is upon her. How's it possible? I'm married, okay? So if I'm married and my wife can't go to respond to her my wife can't sit in her mother's seat. She can't fulfill that because I have some domain over her. She can't not contradict her mother because I have domain over her. There's no conflict. So even though we are discussing here the technical definition of mora, what is the Gemara actually talking about, which might raise a conflict between husband and parent, and kibud,
service.
So now this could be an issue. If I want a glezolite now, and my mother-in-law wants a glezolite, who does my wife have to respond to first? The Gemara says she has to respond to me first. So therefore, Ish can always fulfill the mitzvah of Ich Imo Ve'av Tirao, even though it's not really Tirao, because we're not talking about Yira. Talking about Kibud. And the word Ish doesn't appear by Kibud. It says Kabeid Et Avicha Ve'et Imecha. It doesn't say Ish Kabeid Et Avicha Ve'et Imecha. So number one, it's unusual that a braita would engage itself in this type of a discussion on a pasuk for which the application has no meaning, no significance whatsoever. The application can only be in a situation when you're dealing with kibud, and which would mean that in this Gemara, the Gemara is using kibud and yira rather loosely, which we will see on the next page. They don't want to use it loosely. Kibud is kibud and yira is yira. But I just point out that when you read this Gemara and the Gemara comes up with an answer, the reason why the Torah says ish imo ve'avav tirao, because ish sipek biyadol asol, A husband, a man, has an opportunity to respond to his parents anytime that they have a quest. He must be at their beck and call at any time. The wife does not have to be at her parents' beck and call based on the fact that her husband has some degree of control over her. So therefore, Isha, ein biyadala asot, dipnei shirishut achirim aleha.
So he should be...
Yeah. Not to the exclusion. That if there is a conflict, his parents go first.
So in that respect.
In her case, if there is a conflict, the husband goes first. Yeah.
What if a man or a woman has young children that just can't wait, you know, and they're hungry or whatever, would that also take precedence?
In which case?
Well, you know, you have a baby that's hungry.
Right.
And you have either a man or a woman whose parent is requesting something, and the baby wants to be fed.
Okay, so is the mother and the father both home for the kids? So the mother will feed the kids, and the husband will go take care of his parents. If there's nobody home, that's something else. Then, of course, you have to take care of your kids first. You can't abandon your children, little children, and go to your parents.
So,
but if all things are equal and there is ample opportunity to take somebody to take care of the children, yes, the husband has to.
I'm saying if no one else were available.
If there's no one, then the children's safety and welfare are going to take priority. 100%. Can't abandon children. Yeah.
So why are you interpreting it as the husband having the control over the wife? Why couldn't it be sociological experience of usually, especially in those days, the wife left the home of her parents to join the mother-in-law in her tent, or the husband's domain, wherever it be, whether it's a different shtetl or...
Okay.
Meaning that she's not available to take care of her parents in that same way because she's now in the domain of her husband.
Okay, that's assuming that they're all living in the same house at that time. But what happens if they weren't there?
But this is not,
the Gemara is not offering a sociological analysis. It's issuing a halachic analysis.
So why would you go halachic into control? That's what I'm asking. Why would you go meaning into control?
Because I have to know why is it that she is exempt from the mitzvah of Kibbut Avayim? Why? Why is she exempt from the mitzvah of Kibbut Avayim? And the answer is...
She's not able to be anywhere in the vicinity.
Why not?
Because that wasn't what they did.
But that's not a halach parameter. That would be a different situation. If you live 80 miles away, the husband can't go running to his parents either in 2 seconds. That's a physical fact. One lives in Israel, you know. Your mother calls you up from Israel, oh, can you get me a glass of tea? Oh, okay, you know, I got to buy a flight, I got to get on a flight, you know. It's a little unreasonable. We're trying to establish halakhic categories. When you respond, when you don't respond. And then as a category, you can't look at it from a sociological point of view that usually the wife moved into the husband's parents' house. Yeah, well, that's correct. Rushut achirim aleha. That's the husband's. Yes, that is correct. Rashi says so explicitly. If you take a look on the right-hand side of the page, about halfway, I didn't bracket it. Rushut achirim, the bold caption.
Ba'ala.
Her husband. Her husband. Yeah. Now. Tosafot will deal with an issue. Why is it that Rashut Ba'ala Aleha? What halachic basis generates this particular fact? What halachic basis leads to this conclusion? So, initially, Tosas is going to propose, on account of the fact that Ma'ase Yadeha go Leba'ala. Ma'ase Ma'ase Yadeha. Her earnings. Her earnings go to her husband. So if the earnings go to her husband, if she would now respond every time her mother or father says, what? you know what? I need a glass of tea. What can she not be doing?
Making
money for him. She can't be doing what she normally does to earn something. And that goes to him. So since he has the right over her ma'aseh yodayim, that gives him a certain degree of control. That's what Tosis thinks might be the reason, but rejects it immediately, because the obligation to render ma'aseh yodayim to the ba'al is only midurabanan. Torah law doesn't exist. By Torah law, a woman's earnings are to be kept for herself. It's kept for herself. The Rabbanan said that ma'aseh yadayim it's in trade. There is an exchange. Why does she have to turn over the ma'aseh yadayim? Why? Because what does she get in return? Mizonot. Exactly. It's a trade. But she has a right to say, "Eini zonate for eini osa." You know what? I'll buy my own bagel for breakfast. I don't need you buying me a bagel for breakfast. But my earnings are mine. That's her right. So the whole thing is the Rabbanan. So if the whole thing is the Rabbanan, we could not establish the halachic parameters of a din de oraisa based on an explanation which is only midrabbanan. So Tosfos rejects it. Let's read the Tosfos. I bracket it on the right hand side. Tosafot. Sheyesh reshut achirim aleha. Says Tosafot. Af al gav, even though dimba'ase yadeha leba'ala, even though her earnings go to the husband, and that could have sufficed to generate the reason for our halacha, says Tosafot, no. That's midirabanan ba'alma. That's only midirabanan. Mikol makom. So what must be the reason? Eina mitsuya eitzel aviha ella eitzel ba'ala. No. Just the opposite. Where is she living?
With her husband.
With her husband. Not necessarily with her parents. She said because she's the parents are living with his parents.
No, she moves in with her husband's family.
She living with the husband.
Right.
So now, if she's living with the husband, and the husband has a right to ask her to make a glass of tea, therefore, since he is living with her all the time, his right to ask for a glass of tea takes priority over somebody else where she has to travel to respond to the same particular case.
And she wouldn't be asked because she's living...
She might be asked. She might be.
But then why wouldn't that work just as well the other way around? That a man would be obligated to his wife above his parents? Because he's living with her all the time.
Okay, because he is not necessarily obligated to do the types of services that a wife is obligated to provide to the husband. He's not. And, well, we're not going to like it, but...
Is there a hierarchy as to which child in the pecking order has more of an obligation, or they're all equally obligated?
No, all equally obligated, and a parent has a right to ask any one of their children to provide this service for them. I don't know what the halacha would say if a parent just says, you know what? You decide amongst yourself who does this service for me. I don't know. I have to check. I don't know. But there's no specific pecking order as to which child responds to a parent's need. So let's examine this a little further. So here we establish this obligation. The Chassam Sofer draws a very interesting conclusion from this particular halacha. Very interesting conclusion. Is there a halacha that you have to provide kibud for your in-laws? Do you have to provide kibud on a din de oraisa level? I'm not saying you should be a jerk and anything, but mid de oraisa, is one obligated to be mechabed in-laws?
Well, a woman's standpoint, if when they are married, their obligation is more towards their husband, so then doesn't it by default then go on to his parents?
Interesting. Okay. But use what you just said in the reverse case.
Yes, I don't want to look at it that way.
No, but use the reverse case, and then you'll come to a shocking conclusion, which the Chassam Sofer did.
Yeah, the reverse is that since she's married, so therefore she has, so that since he has more an obligation to his parents, therefore he has none to her parents. Sharper.
If let's leave it. Let's just. I'll give you the test case. If he was obligated to be mechabed his in-laws, what would happen when there is a conflict between he wants a glass of tea and her parents want a glass of tea? What would he have to do? What would he have to do? He would have to tell his wife, take care of your parents. Why? Because I'm obligated to be mechabed them too. I am also obligated. So if I'm obligated to be mechabed them, by default, you now have to go and what? And provide the service against, even though I want something now as well.
So now,
since the Gemara has just established that what is the fact about the woman when she is in a conflict between herself, between her husband and her parents, who should he tend to? The husband, apparently, says the Chassam Sofer. There is no obligation upon the husband to be mechabed his in-laws.
What about the
Nezer? Oh, just one second. Let me just repeat it.
That's what I said.
There is no obligation to be mechabed the in-laws, because if children would be obligated mid the oraisa to be mechabed the in-laws, the psak halacha of this Gemara would be incorrect. Because every time the mother's, the wife's parents asked for something, there would be two reasons for the wife to respond to do it. One, her parents are asking her. And number two, his in-laws are asking. And he's also obligated to do it. So you might as well have it done.
What about her obligations to his parents?
Okay, but that's... So
she is obligated to be mechaber his parents, okay. Because he has to.
So some Sofer's in-laws doesn't exist.
Totally. But it's his parents. His parents because they are the parents of the husband who she is obligated to.
She does not have an achrayis to his parents.
But if he has the obligation to his parents,
she would have. But if he would have, says the Chassam Sofer, the psak of the Gemara would be different. If there was an obligation upon me to be mechabed my mother-in-law, whenever I asked my wife to do something for me, and my mother-in-law asked her to do something for her, I would have to defer to my mother-in-law, because not only is my wife under kibud avim, I am obligated to be mechabed her. So my directive would have to be to my wife. You know what? Don't listen to what I say. Go be mechabed your parents. Since the Gemara says she is to ignore her parental request and listen to her husband, apparently, says the Chassam Sofer, there is no mitzvah of kibud of shvege and shver.
Of the man, and he generalizes for both.
That is correct. He comes to the...
They're not the same.
Correct. I grant you that. But category of in-laws, he feels, has been rejected by this Gemara. Yes?
I'm having a little trouble why he has to ask this question. Because if you take it to its logical conclusion, then he has an obligation to put on fillet, so she should be obligated to put on fillet.
No. If there was an obligation in general to be mechabed your in-laws... Okay? So now, when there is a conflict, I ask my wife to do something, and her parents ask her to do something. What did the Gemara say she should do? What did the Gemara just say she should do? She should do what I want and do not honor her parents' request. But if I... A 90-year-old woman. But if... yeah, let's just... Right. But... But if I would be obligated to be mechabed my in-laws, I would never have a right to tell my wife, provide the cup of tea for me. I would have to tell her, go provide the cup of tea for you, because I also have to be mechabed them. So there would never be a resolution that she should honor me whenever there's a conflict between me and my in-laws.
And if it were transgender, you start a lot of control, because then you'd be
obligated
to your grandparents.
Hold on. No, we will talk about grandparents, and not this year, next year.
Oh,
there will be a discussion about grandparents. This is what the Chassam Sofer says. Our Gemara comes to that conclusion. Our Gemara... However, listen to this. The Sefer HaChassidim writes... written by Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, Sefer Chassidim says that every good husband should always want his wife to be mekayin mitzvah of kibud av va'em. Every good husband, for her parents, every good husband should always enable his wife, even though, as our Gemara says, "Reshut acherim aleha," it doesn't mean that she's not allowed to go and respond to her parents. It means that if you make a decision, the husband has a right to dictate. Says the Sefer Chassidim, if you really want to be a good husband, what you should always do is waive your right and promote your wife's opportunity to be mekayin the mitzvah of kibud av va'em. Kibud av va'em. Even though halachically there may not be any imperative to do so, but that's what a good husband should do. So says the Sefer Chassidim. Sefer Chassidim. What is that? Yeah. Now, this phrase, Rishut Acherim Aleha, the Rav once used, and I mentioned this the seventh night of Yontiv, as a partial explanation to a very famous halacha. The din is that when you observe a practice three times, it's considered like a neder, and you have to make hatarat nedarim to release you of that particular neder. So, it's a very famous illustration. The Rav used to stand for chazaras hashatz with his feet together every time chazaras hashatz. And Yom Kippur for Musaf was 3 hours. He stood with his feet together for 3 hours. And in one of his later years, his doctor told him, Rebbele, you're not allowed to stand for 3 hours. I'm not allowing you to stand for Chazar Sashatz. So he was right in shul, right before Musaf. He was sat, made a little bezdin, and he was matur neder. He said, had I known that my doctor is going to tell me when I'm 85 years old that I'm not allowed to stand for Chazar Sashatz, I would never have done so 90 years ago when I was a 5-year-old kid. I would never have done so and taken that minig upon myself. Fine, you need a Taras Nadar. However, here is the following case. You live in a community where they don't eat gebracht. Okay? It's a real community. You live in the Hasidic world and they don't eat gebracht. Then you move, you decided to become a little more modernish, and you move to Teaneck, New Jersey. And in Teaneck, New Jersey, everybody eats gebracht. So there is a fundamental debate between the Rush and the Rambam. If somebody moves to a different community, permanent change of residence, is that individual duty bound to continue the minhagim of the community from which they came? Everyone agrees that when you're traveling as a temporary resident, of course you must. You have to take the stringencies of the community which you're in and the stringencies of the community which you left. That everyone agrees. But there is a machlokes between the Rambam and the Rush about a situation where you're going to move permanently. The Rambam writes, you still have to maintain all of the stringencies of the community which you came from, even though you know if you're going to live there again. And the Rush writes, no. The minute you change your residence, you don't need Ataras Nedarim, nothing. You move into a new community, you have a right to adopt the Minhagim of that particular community. Fine. That's what the Rush says. Point case number two, then we'll put them together. I would imagine here that when you got married, you may have noticed different minhagim between the husband and the wife when you got married.
Yeah.
Sometimes major differences, right? Waiting 3 hours versus 6 hours. Eating gebracht, not eating gebracht. If you get a kal v'chaymer, if you marry Sfardin, eating kitnios on Pesach. All different types of things. Lots of different things. The common practice is that the wife adopts the husband's minhagim. That's the common practice. I would imagine that one of the reasons why anybody has to accommodate anyone, why can't everybody just maintain their own minhagim? Because when raising children, it's important to show that, you know, there's some consistency in the house, and not, you know, my mother's eating kidneys, I'm not eating kidneys. I understand that. But why is it that the practice has become that the wife has to adopt the husband's community, the minhagim?
Because she
generally needs his community. So here's what the Rav said. Listen carefully. The phrase which the Gemara uses when you don't plan on going back to your community is Ein dato lachzor. Ein dato lachzor. When you move to a new community, you're not planning on going back to the old one. Ein lecha ein dato lachzor gedoy lemizu. That when you get married, at least while you're married, you know that you're in the next neighborhood. You're in that neighborhood. You're not going back to the old neighborhood. And that's why it now almost dictates that you're in the new reshut, like the Gemara says, reshut acherim aleha. She is now in a new reshut. Hence, she adopts the practice of her new reshut. And the new reshut is the husband's domain. Hence, the practice has become that the wife adopts the practices, the minhagim, and the stringencies of the husband, not vice versa. Not vice versa.
I don't follow that logic. Didn't he just as much move into her new neighborhood when he married her?
No, because his, again, Rashut Acherim Aleha, our Gemara says, is that he has certain degree of control over her, which she does not exercise over him.
Would that be Midirabana, is that right?
What?
That would be considered Midirabana.
Yes, I would say so, yes.
Because you have learned it from Bakkalim that she can't get kachin and things like this? Because she's now an Indramina.
That's an interesting point. You know, a Bat Kohen who gets married to a Yisrael is not allowed to. Even though that might be, it's an interesting point. That might be because they're afraid that she's going to give him something and he's not allowed to eat the kachim. But it might be a very good point for that. I have to think about that. It's very possible. It is very possible. Yes, it is very possible. I'm not saying no. Next line of the Gemara. Amar Rav Idi Bar Oven, Amar Rav Idi Bar Oven said in the name of Rav, nitgarsha shnehem shavim. If she gets divorced, then under those circumstances, what happens?
She has the same obligation
that the man has to his parents, she now has to her parents. Okay? That's what he says. So I ask you, ladies and ladies, let's assume he didn't say this. What would you have thought the halacha would be if somebody gets divorced? What would you think the halacha is? Yeah, so then what question you have to ask? What's the idiot? If everybody here would come to the same conclusion, what do I need Rav Yehuda Baravin? Says the Ritva.
But you wouldn't think it's a
Shneya. Yeah, Shneya means the husband and the wife. The man and the woman, it means man. It means the man and the woman are now obligated equally in the midst of Kibbutz Av V'Ein. She to her parents and him to his parents.
So it just reverts back to what it was before they were married.
Correct. So that the question was, I don't need an Amoraic sage to teach me that when it is perfectly logical and everybody would come to that very same conclusion. So what is, says the Ritva, I'll tell you what the Chiddush is. I could have imagined that once somebody is exempt from a mitzvah, perhaps the exemption remains with her, perhaps. When you get married, somehow you are released of the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av V'Ein to some extent. So perhaps I could have thought that this exemption remains attached to this woman for the rest of her life. Says Rabbi Dibaravin, reject that possibility. No. It's not a status that a woman has acquired that she's exempt from the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av V'Ein. It's just a practical issue. It's not that she's exempt. It's just that practically she can't implement it. Hence, the moment she gets divorced, when that opportunity to what? To fulfill it does exist, she is now once again obligated to perform that particular mitzvah. Yeah. Yeah, it would be the same thing. Same thing. Yeah.
Well, so let's say she's a widow. He was an only child. She doesn't take on his responsibilities towards his parents.
Absolutely not. No.
When
yes.
When she gets divorced, the expectation is that she moves back to
her what?
She moves back to her parents' home after divorce.
She doesn't have to, but she.
No, but
often that was the case.
Back
yeah.
Then,
back then it probably happened more often than not.
Right.
That's correct. But even if she didn't, if she's independently wealthy, she's still obligated to provide Kibbutz Av V'Ein.
Right.
Still obligated to provide Kibbutz Av V'Ein.
What I find bothersome is the fact that they really had to mention was that you're obligated to. It's not something that
really think would be. Okay. I understand. Okay, it's always heartwarming to think that a child's relationship with a parent would be such that they recognize and appreciate what the parents have done for them and would be willing to respond without a command. Unfortunately, we all know too many cases where the child is not particularly enamored or appreciative of their parents' efforts. And without the halachic dictate, you know, even sometimes with the halachic dictate, they don't do anything. But certainly without the halachic dictate, there'd be no interest whatsoever. None whatsoever.
That's surprising. We have a halachic imperative not to murder.
What?
We have a halachic imperative not to murder.
That's correct.
I mean, we're told all the time.
Correct.
Halachically to do things that you would...
Correct. And we know why. I once mentioned this to you. I was not going to mention, but now that you throw that point in, there is a famous debate which Rashi only presents half the case in, half the argument. In the introductory verse to the Aseret HaDibrot, the introductory verse, Chapter 20, verse 1 of Sefer Shemot. It's the easiest pasuk in the Chumash. Vayidaber Elohim et kol hadvarim ha'ela lemor. Any third grader, a second grader, can translate that pasuk. Yet Rashi finds every word in that pasuk difficult. And there are long Rashis on every word. On the word lemor, Rashi adds a comment. Says Rashi, that the word, what does the word lemor normally mean? Vayidaber Hashem o Moshe lemor. It's probably that pasuk is repeated more often than any other pasuk. What does the word lemor mean? What do you mean saying? It says Vayidaber. Of course he was saying. So what does lemor mean? What does it mean? To tell it to someone else. Because there were certain conversations between God and Moshe which were privileged. Vayidaber Hashem o Moshe. He didn't have to tell that anybody. When it says lemor, then that indicates that this is not privileged information. Mo, you have to go ahead and share it with Am Yisrael. Good. When you're standing at Har Sinai and God is about to speak the Aseret HaDibrot, what question is Rashi going to ask? Who needs word lemor? You're going to hear it directly from God. So it should have said, Vayidaber Elohim et kol hadvarim ha'ele. God spoke all of these words. Everybody's hearing it directly. So what does the word lemor mean? Answers Rashi, that here the word lemor meant that there was a response. A response. And Rashi quotes the following response to teach us that for all positive commandments, they said yes, hein. For all negative commandments, they said no, lo. So when God read, Kabedus Avicha Esimecha, they said, we'll do that. When God said, lo tirtzach, they said, we won't do that. That's what Rashi says. It's taken straight out of the Mechilta, and Rashi only gave you one opinion, Rabbi Yishmael's opinion. He said that they used to say yes on every positive commandment, no on every positive commandment. Negative. On every negative commandment. Rabbi Akiva says they said yes for every positive commandment and yes for every negative commandment. Ask the Rav. I remember this like yesterday. Muncie Park Hotel. 1972, terrible blizzard was Parshas Yisro in the middle of winter. The Rav always spoke at the midwinter convention of the RCA. I had the good privilege of driving him up. It was like a terrible, terrible storm. And he spoke about this whole pasuk. That's what the whole shir was. Understanding the introductory verse to the Aseret Dibrot, Rashi by Rashi. So the Rav explained, what's the debate between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon? What's the debate? And he said, an English teacher will explain the debate for you. Mm-hmm. Here is the case. A mother calls her child and says, Yankala, I don't want you to play with Moshe. I don't want you to play with Moshe. Tell me the difference of the responses. No, I will not play with Moshe. Yes, I will not play with Moshe. What's the difference?
The second one implies obedience.
Correct. No, I won't apply to Moshe is because I fully concur with your judgment. Moshe is the biggest idiot on the planet. He's abusive, he does this, he's a terrible influence, he smokes marijuana. You're right, I shouldn't talk to him, I shouldn't be friends with him. When you say, yes, mother, I will not play with Moshe, it means, mother, you don't know what you're talking about. Moshe's the most nicest guy on the planet. But yes, I defer to your authority. I defer to your authority. You're my mother, I defer to you. The machloikis between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel is, why should we observe Lo Tirtzach? Says Rabbi Shmuel, Lo Tirtzach, you can say Lo. Why? Like you just said, we all understand why you should not murder somebody. We all understand that. Says Rabbi Akiva, there's going to be a time when you will not understand that you shall not murder. You have this 95-year-old person struggling, you know, doesn't know what's going on anymore, and then, okay, so you'll cut off his you know, no, whatever it is. You pull the plug, exactly. That's murder. That's murder. So sometimes you have to say, for even things which are sad, you go and calls mitzvot sichliot, which the logic understands them. You don't need a Kodesh Baruch Hu. You have to say, you know what? I'm going to observe them because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said so. Because sometimes, without it, you come to the conclusion, you know what? My parents were terrible parents, and therefore I don't owe them anything. Says HaKadosh, says the mitzvah, you might think so, you're entitled to your opinion, but I'm telling you, you got to be respectful. Got to be respectful. Yeah, and you know, sometimes you see kids who are, it's just hard to understand them. How kids can be so disrespectful to a parent. It's just hard to imagine. It's hard to understand them. Yeah. Okay. What time is it? Talk to them. Okay, we'll stop here. Next week, regular week, and we'll continue with the next Gemara, which broadens the halach of Kibud Av V'Aim, establishes a connection between Kibud Av V'Aim and Kibud HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how far the Gemara is willing to take that, and then the definition and a titanic machlokes between the Rav and Rav Moshe, how to understand Shelo Yistor et Devarav, the critical machlokes between the Rav and Rav Moshe. It's the most famous case around. 1963, when a family in Borough Park knew them very well, the Kramers. The husband had a wonderful job opportunity in Israel, and he was about to make a move. His parents said, I don't want you to go. He said, you know what? We'll ask Rav Moshe Shaila. And Rav Moshe said, you don't go. Because Kibud Av V'Aim triumphs going to Israel. And the Rav vehemently disagreed. We'll see what the psak is. We'll see what the kernel of the debate is. Parents love Rav Moshe. Children love the Rav.